If you were listening to the film on Rashi, I hope you noticed that Rashi's daughters were discussing that very passage in the Gemara that we talked about, Rabba Bar Bar Chana breaking the wine and everything else. So, either one, it's fine. It's too much.
Beer. You
can turn it to a lower setting if you want. That's fine, yeah. That's better? And we were discussing yesterday the Gemara in Erchin. And the Gemara in Erchin says that a minority of people sin sexually, a majority of people sin in matters of theft, and everybody sins in matters of lashon hara. And we were talking about the idea of theft, etc. But now I just want to talk about another aspect that many, many Jews don't even know. And that is, we really have two principles which on one level run at cross purposes. There is a principle in Jewish law that says, Dina de Malchus Adina, the law of the state is the law. That means Jews are obligated to obey the secular laws of the society that they are in. What does that mean? That means, for example, if there's a law that says you have to pay taxes, and one does not pay the taxes that the secular law says you're supposed to pay, that is not only a violation of the secular law, but that is considered to be a violation of Jewish law, because Jewish law obligates us to obey the secular law of the government that we are in. In fact, there is even a psak. You know, there are many businesses that have that operate out of basements, and the businesses that operate out of basements are often on a cash basis. You have to buy by cash, and one of the reasons why these businesses only accept cash is because they don't want to have sales tax. If there's a record by credit card or check, the government can trace what was purchased, and then they'd have to pay taxes. So there was a psak from Rav Soloveitchik of the Yeshiva University who actually said, you're not allowed to patronize a business that does a cash only, because you are facilitating, you are causing them to transgress the aveira of not paying taxes. And even though you're not the one that's not paying, but you're causing them to not pay, and therefore that is called lifnei iver lo sitein michshol, that says in front of a blind person, do not put a stumbling block. Right?
That doesn't mean you can't buy things with cash.
Well, you can't buy things from a business where it's likely that because they only accept cash, they're doing so for the evasion of taxes. If you buy things for cash in a regular business that takes other things, then you have no reason to assume that they're evading taxes. But a business that says, we do not take credit cards, we do not take check, we only take cash, one has to be suspicious that the purpose of that business is not to pay taxes. That doesn't mean that is the case. And in any event, not everybody agrees with that shot, because there are people that say that's their problem, meaning to say, you're willing to pay the tax, but they're not withholding it from your cash payment. And therefore, that's their avera, not yours. But the question still becomes that the law of not putting a stumbling block in front of a blind man is interpreted to mean that even if I don't do a sin, I'm not supposed to cause another person to do a sin. So that's Dina de Malchus Adina.
Doesn't that contradict the injunction of judging somebody to the good rather than to the bad?
Yes. Generally speaking, you judge people favorably. However, if your purpose is to prevent a sin from being committed, you are permitted and even obligated to judge that there is a possibility of aveira, and you want to prevent it. In other words, ultimately, it's for that person's spiritual good that you're not going to do something that may cause an aveira. Now, the issue that the law of the land is the law can obviously not mean exactly in its totality, because what if the law says desecrate Shabbos? Mm-hmm. Or what if the law says women are divorced by a secular judge and not by a get? So obviously it was understood at a very early time that the principle of Dina de Malchus Adina never meant that secular law governs everything, because if that would be the case, you could throw out the whole Torah. So all of the Rishonim try to give us narrowing definitions to indicate when it applies, when doesn't it apply. So the most accepted definition says that Dina de Malchus Adina applies only in the areas such as taxation and areas where the government promulgates general health and safety regulations in order to protect the public at large. You'll see in a moment what this wouldn't include. Therefore, for example, Dina de Malchus Adina would apply for taxation, of course. It would apply for health regulations, it would apply to occupational safety, the types of precautions that workers have to have. It would apply to environmental laws, such as pollution, anti-pollution laws, minimum wage laws. It would apply to child labor laws, those things that are designed to protect the public. However, Dina de Malchus Adina, according to many opinions, does not apply in the private laws that govern one person and another person. So, for example, if I make a contract with you, and secular law would interpret the contract one way, and halacha would interpret the contract another way, the law of contract is not something that pertains to the public welfare as a whole. It is simply the private rule that applies between one Jew and another Jew. So most opinions say that Dina de Malchus Adina does not govern the private rules between one person and another person. And at that point, that would have to be governed by the laws of the Torah and the laws of the Shulchan Aruch. So as between a Jew and a non-Jew, the Torah, generally speaking, does not govern those relations. But as between a Jew and a Jew, the Torah would govern. Thus, for example, if I have a partnership with you, even Dina de Malchus Adina would not mean it's governed by secular law, but it means it would be governed by Torah law. However, in this sense, there's one very, very important exception in many areas. And that is, in many, many areas, the halacha itself is defined by whatever is the prevailing custom among people. Meaning the halacha is, if we agree on something, the way the agreement is interpreted is based on the custom that exists in that community. Now, even when Dina de Malchus Adina does not apply as a direct principle, but if the law of the land is the way most people, including non-Jews, conduct their business, it in effect becomes the minhag hamakam, it becomes the local custom, and therefore it may come into a practice as the halacha itself. So there are two different levels here. There's Dina de Malchus Adina, and then there is the use of Dina de Malchus to establish what is the minhag against which a commercial transaction takes effect. Now let me give you a concrete illustration of what we're talking about. Let's take something like bankruptcy. Right? Bankruptcy is, at least American bankruptcy, is an institution where if a debtor owes a lot of money to different people, the creditor can go through a bankruptcy proceeding. And at the end of the bankruptcy proceeding, whatever was owed is wiped off the slate. In other words, even if my creditors only get 10 cents on the dollar, or they only get 5 cents on the dollar, a judge will declare, I do not have to pay the other 95%. That is called a bankruptcy discharge. Now, that doesn't work for all debts. Most taxes don't get wiped off the slate. Alimony, child support, doesn't get wiped off the slate. Student loan obligations don't get wiped off the slate. It's very interesting, because what happened was, there were doctors who graduated medical school before they had any job, and they owed $100,000 in student loans. They'd file a bankruptcy, wipe it off the slate, and then get very cushy jobs. So Congress enacted that, student loans, etc. But Bederech Klal, medical expenses, a lot of these things, get wiped off the slate. So here's the question. Jewish law does not recognize, by and large, the ability of a debtor to simply escape financial obligations. If I owe you money, even if I'm poor, so there are laws that you're not allowed to harass me or collect from me until I have more money, but it doesn't wipe it off the slate. The only thing that is analogous to a bankruptcy discharge in Jewish law is Shemitah. The sabbatical year, which not only says in the land of Israel, you're not allowed to work the land, but the sabbatical year also cancels debts. That if I owe you money and the Shemitah year comes, it's the whole Shemitah. So the end of the Shemitah, the last day of Shemitah, the debt is erased. I don't have to pay you. But even that, we know that Hillel made a takana, which would allow debts to survive Shemitah. Because what was Hillel afraid of? Hillel was afraid of that poor people would be unable to obtain loans right before Shemitah, because rich people wouldn't give them the money because they wouldn't get it back. So Hillel made a takana, and that takana is called Prusbel, whereby, in effect, a lender goes in front of a Beis Din of three, and he transfers to the base then the loan. In other words, he says to the base then, I hereby transfer my debt to you, and you in turn authorize me to collect it. Now, why does Prisbo work? Prisbo works because the law that Shemitah cancels a loan only applies to loans that are owed to private people. It does not apply to loans that are owed to a court system. So, for example, a traffic ticket would not get canceled by Shemitah, even in a Jewish court. And what Prisbo does is, Prisbo is an assignment of the loan to a Beisdin. And this is something that applies even today. If you're owed money, then before the Shemitah year, you should stand before a Beisdin, and there's a misach, there's a text that you say, and you say, I hereby give to the Beisdin my ownership in the loan, and they in turn authorize me to collect it.
The Torah, we're not standing up to deals, and that we have to
well, yeah, well, the answer once again is that Hillel recognized that human nature was not living up to
the
Torah's
idea.
Well, the Torah was written in terms of, we always find this, when the Chachamim, you know, add takanos or gezeros, the Torah recognizes that it sometimes promulgates the ideal that human beings should aspire to, but it gives the Chachamim the flexibility and the wherewithal to be able to adjust to the reality until we reach that stage of an ideal. That's the whole concept of rabbinic supplementation of the Torah, which the Torah itself authorizes. So it's not, the rabbis are not adding to the Torah, because the Torah itself gave the rabbis the power to make that type of legislation. However, the bottom line is that other than Shemitah, which in any event is circumvented by Prisbo, there is no concept of bankruptcy. You can't just get out of paying your loan.
Yeah.
Would it be possible to do the same thing that we do with comments on loans before Pesach, to transfer the loan to a non-Jew?
That's an interesting question. If you transfer the loan to a non-Jew, presumably the non-Jew would have the right to collect it, because the non-Jew is not governed by the laws of Shemitah. The question then would be, you'd have to make an arrangement though that he would turn over the money to you.
As we do with Hamas.
Yeah, yeah. All right, it'd be a little harder to structure, but yeah, theoretically that would work as well. That would work as well. Although Prisbel is easier, because Prisbel, you're not dealing with a non-Jew. You know, even with chametz, we have all sorts of questions. The non-Jew can keep the chametz, etc.
And not even back to assumes access to a Beis Din.
Well, by a Beis Din, though, we don't need it. We don't mean a Beis Din of professional rabbis. You know, three people to be a Beis Din. So you can get three friends to be the dayanim of the Prisbel. So here's my question: I'm a firm Jew. I owe money to a lot of people. I'm in financial difficulty. Am I allowed to file for bankruptcy and not pay them? Because keep in mind, in terms of Torah law, not paying a creditor is theft. It's geneva. In other words, it is a form of geneva. Not non-payment of debt is geneva. Under civil law, this is a legitimate mechanism for the non-payment of debts. Now, it is on your credit record. If you do file for bankruptcy, it does remain a black mark on your credit record for up to 10 years. It's then taken off.
Aside from fraud. I mean, you
we're not talking about that. That's very true. If you borrow money with the intention that tomorrow you're going to file for bankruptcy, that's a debt incurred by fraud, and bankruptcy doesn't work. Yeah, that's not my question. Yeah. My question is, though, that you borrowed the money with the intention of paying. 2 years later, you have financial difficulties. And because you have financial difficulties, you file for bankruptcy. So under secular law, this is legitimate, and your debt will be wiped off the slate. The question is a Jew allowed to do that? Because he's violating halacha by not paying his creditors. Right? So that's a very important question. Is a Jew allowed, is a Torah-driven Jew, allowed to invoke bankruptcy relief? Now, it would appear the following. Vis-a-vis my non-Jewish creditors, there appears to be no question, because my relationships with my non-Jewish creditors are primarily governed by the secular law of society and not by halacha. And if secular law says bankruptcy is okay, bankruptcy is okay. But the problem is, what about the money that I owe Jewish people? Can I get out of paying them by invoking bankruptcy? So here, there are three opinions in halacha. There are three opinions among the poskim whether a religious Jew is allowed to file for a bankruptcy. Opinion number one is very strong. Opinion number one says, no. Opinion number one says, not paying a Jewish creditor is theft according to halacha, and even if secular law says it is all right, you are obligated to follow the Torah law, and therefore you must pay. Now, what that means is a little tricky. That doesn't mean you can't file for bankruptcy, because after all, if you have Jews and non-Jews, you may want to file not to pay the non-Jews. But it does mean you are obligated, even after a bankruptcy, to enter into a repayment negotiation, which is possible under secular law. By the way, under secular law, it is entirely possible, even after you've gone through a bankruptcy, to enter into agreements with individual people to pay them back. You may want to do so for moral obligation. You may want to do so because, well, I'll give you a simple example. Again, I don't want to get too many secular examples here, but let's assume that you use the bankruptcy to get out of paying a credit card. Now, once you've gone through the bankruptcy, you cannot be forced to pay the credit card, but they have the right to cancel the card on you. So you may enter into a post-bankruptcy agreement to pay all or part of a credit card balance, not because you have to, but because you need it in order to keep the card. Or let's say you have a dentist, and you have five kids that need braces. And one of the kids, you've already incurred a $10,000 bill, so you go through bankruptcy. Well, that's fine. You don't have to pay that bill, but he's not going to treat your other children. Right? So there are reasons for selectively agreeing to pay a debt. And the point that these poskim say is that if any of your creditors are Jewish, this is view number one. There are three views. View number one says you are halachically obligated to agree to pay that money. Yeah.
Kniva, if you have a chag.
What's the first word you said?
Kniva.
Yes.
Kniva has a
yes.
Debt. It doesn't allow for intent. Intent is, has no.
No, intent is no. In other words, if you take that which does not belong to you, according to halacha, that is kniva. So, according to this opinion, even a legally legitimate non-payment of a loan is halachic theft, and therefore you must endeavor to pay those loans. That's opinion number one. Yeah.
So a person is judged in the same way. A person that goes and holds up a bank or steals something with full intent of depriving the person of the goods is judged in exactly the same way as somebody...
Well, no, so that already is a semantic confusion. In other words, the fact that something is the same sin, meaning it's categorized as the same sin, does not go to the severity in which different forms of the same sin may be judged. For example, if I kill somebody, whether it's by accident or on purpose, the sin is the sin of murder. However, the way we judge intentional homicide is a different standard than the way we judge unintentional. So obviously, in terms of severity of heavenly judgment, the intentional crime is much worse than the unintentional crime. However, that does not mean that the unintentional crime is not a crime. It still is, although there are mitigating factors in its severity. But on the other hand, I would also say this. A guy who says, I'm not paying you because I went through a bankruptcy, I wouldn't even call that inadvertent. In other words, he knows he's not paying. He knows he's withholding from a creditor what that creditor owes. That's not even unintentional. That according to these opinions. Yes. Yes, but that's an after-the-fact knowledge that he is withholding what he owes. All right, so that's view number one. I'm going to take two other views in a second. Yeah.
This is voluntary bankruptcy. What about involuntary? It has ill intentions.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They put him in bankruptcy.
That's a very good point, but I think the conclusion will still be the same, because even if he was put into bankruptcy against his will, creditors can put someone into bankruptcy, but the decision later whether to pay or not to pay is up to him, and therefore halacha would still say, okay, you were put into bankruptcy, but you gotta, this is called reaffirmation, you gotta agree to pay those debts that were discharged.
Got a non-Jew to buy the Jewish debt.
In other words, the creditor sold his debt to a non-Jew.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that would do it at that point.
The other way. He knows.
Well, that's right. When did the Jew sell it? If a Jew sold the debt after the bankruptcy, he would be stealing
before.
Yeah, at that point it would be on. Well, actually, there's a whole discussion there. But there's a whole discussion. When a guy buys a property right from a Jew, according to halacha, he may have acquired the rights of the Jew. That's the whole issue in that case. Now, there is a second view on this. And the second view says the following. The second view says that bankruptcy is one of the laws on which we apply the principle. The law of the land is the law. Why is that so? Because, this is already more of a legal analysis, but they say that the purpose of bankruptcy law is to protect the economy as a whole by creating mechanisms where if people are financially beleaguered, they have a way of escaping a crushing burden that would destroy them. Therefore, it's a generalized social welfare law. And therefore, based on the principle that social welfare laws pertaining to money and property, not marriage, divorce, of course, but money and property, secular law can govern in a case like this. They do allow the person to invoke the rule of Dina de Malchusa Dina in matters of social welfare and money and property. Again, I do want to emphasize, under all circumstances, Dina de Malchusa Dina is limited totally to money and property things. It does not apply to marriage, it does not apply to divorce, it does not apply to ritual or religious law like Shabbos or Kashrus, but it does apply in monetary matters that pertain to the social welfare. So that's shita number two. There is shita number three that comes to the same conclusion, but for a different reason, and I'll give you a practical difference. Shita number three says like this. What would be the halacha if when I lend you money, we stipulated in the contract like this? We said in the contract that in the event you go through a bankruptcy, you don't have to pay me. If we would have said that explicitly in the contract, halacha would have said, that's fine. If a lender agrees not to be paid, that's fine. So that's step one. Step two makes the following arguments. Since when people lend money, they are aware that there is such a thing called bankruptcy. And they are aware that borrowers sometimes use bankruptcy. And they are aware that once a bankruptcy is finished, the borrower doesn't have to pay. It is as if it was mutually understood at the time of the loan that you don't have to pay me if you go through a bankruptcy. Therefore, this is what is called an implied condition. It's not an express condition.
You're dealing with Jews, even though they know there is such a halacha, they feel that when they're dealing with quota.
This is the question, right. That's the good question. Well, I'll talk about that a little bit. But they make the argument there for the following. They make the argument that even if secular law does not directly apply, but as I indicated, secular law can sometimes establish what the parties anticipate may happen, and therefore it becomes as if there was a condition. Now, if there would have been a condition in the deal, for sure halacha would say you don't have to pay. In other words, if I lend you money and we stipulate in the event, in fact we can stipulate anything, I could say in the event the Orioles win the World Series you don't have to pay me. In other words, that's Tanai. Tanai is a very well established principle of halacha. So you could have a bankruptcy Tanai in the contract, no question about that. Everybody would say that. Even the first opinion would say that. But the chiddush of this third opinion is, the innovation of the third opinion is, that even though no such Tanai was stated, the very existence of a bankruptcy alternative is as if the parties mentioned it. Now, therefore, essentially, this is the reflective of the idea that the customs and practices of a transaction can be as if they were put into the contract, even though they're not. Yeah.
Doesn't the instrument of stipulating which court would deal with any kind of disagreement or breaking of the contract, by stipulating that particular court, whether it's based in all secular court, doesn't just that stipulation deal with the whole?
Well, I'll address that. That's very important. One may argue in favor of this line of reasoning that if you did stipulate a secular court, this contract shall be governed by so-and-so court, although you're not allowed to do that, and I'll get to that, but such a clause may, by definition, be in effect incorporating bankruptcy law. But they're arguing, even if you said, we'll go to a basin, but it's as if you made a bankruptcy tonight. So it turns out that the first view says it's forbidden for an Orthodox Jew to invoke bankruptcy against a Jewish creditor because it's theft. The second view says it is permitted because the law of the land becomes the law with respect to monetary public welfare measures. The third says, even though the law of the land does not directly govern, but here it is as if the parties made a condition, and by the prevailing custom and practice, It is as if there was a bankruptcy escape clause in the contract itself. Now, there is a difference between the second approach and the third approach. And let me give you the following example. In bankruptcy, you can have a lot of different creditors. There are creditors who lent you money, and they are called voluntary creditors because they entered into transactions with you. But then there's a category that is called an involuntary creditor, a person who became your creditor against his will. The example would be a victim of an automobile accident. You ran somebody down. That person is now your creditor. You owe him money, or you damaged his property. So the question is this. If the basis for allowing a bankruptcy escape clause is because the law of the land is the law, in other words, in this area, then that would apply to any type of creditor. Meaning, just like I don't have to pay my lender, I don't have to pay the guy that I ran over, because bankruptcy becomes incorporated as part of the halacha that governs the transaction. I'm not referring to a moral obligation to pay, but in terms of al-pidin, are you chayiv to pay? If, on the other hand, the predicate for the legitimation of bankruptcy is that since those of us who negotiate are aware of this as an alternative, it is as if we stipulated in our contract to have an escape clause, that would not be possible when there was no negotiation. In other words, you can't possibly say that the guy who was run over by a car agreed before he was run over that in the event of a bankruptcy he would not press his claim. He didn't agree to anything because he was not consulted as part of this. In other words, this would only apply when there's a contract, when there's an agreement, when there's a negotiation, we can discuss what was in the minds of the parties.
Well, why wouldn't you make a similar assumption? In other words, anyone who's driving, anyone who's walking, anyone who's doing anything in this society knows there are rules and regulations that deal with taxes.
Yeah, but
therefore, I know there's a bankruptcy, right, and I know that is a possibility in any situation.
Right. Yeah, I understand that, but again, the guy who walks in the street does not expect to get hit by a car.
Whether he expects it or not.
No, but I'll tell you why. Because the idea that bankruptcy becomes part of the contract is based on the idea of the following. It's based on this. If you're negotiating a contract and you know there's an escape clause of bankruptcy, if you didn't want bankruptcy to apply,
right,
you should have put it into the agreement. Therefore, your failure to put it into the agreement indicates your intention that it should normally apply. Now, you can only use that negative reasoning. If you wanted to negate it, you should have put it in when you had an opportunity to put it in or not put it in. In the absence of an opportunity to put it in or not put it in, we cannot say the omission of a clause indicates any intention that it shouldn't apply. So consequently, just to boil this down, if I have, let's imagine, three types of creditors. I have non-Jewish creditors of any type. I have voluntary Jewish creditors who lent me money. And I have involuntary Jewish creditors whose property I damaged or I hurt. Three types of creditors. So, according to all schools of thought, I am permitted to utilize a bankruptcy discharge against my non-Jewish creditors because they are governed by civil law. What about with respect to my Jewish creditors? So it depends. Under opinion number one, that bankruptcy is illegitimate and you're stealing from your Jewish creditors, you would have to pay all of your Jewish creditors. Under opinion number two, that recognizes bankruptcy as a legitimate application of Dina de Malchusa Dina, you would not have to pay any of your Jewish creditors. Under opinion number three, that allows bankruptcy to come in only on the argument that since when you lend money you're aware of a bankruptcy and you didn't put into the contract that it shouldn't apply, it's as if you're working with the standard assumption. We would make a difference between the Jewish creditors who negotiated contracts, in which case that's a good basis not to pay them, and the Jewish creditors who were involuntary, in which case you'd have to pay them, right? So we have that chiluk. Another chiluk, another difference, might be there might be different types of creditors besides the voluntary and involuntary. There might be, you know, a real estate executive, you know, who's very sophisticated, very knowledgeable, knows about bankruptcy, and then there might be your Aunt Tilly, who lent you $500, not even knowing there's such a thing. See, once again, if Dina de Malchusa Dina applies, it applies to Aunt Tilly as well as it applies to a sophisticated banker. But if it becomes a matter of, well, if you knew there was a bankruptcy, you should have put it in, that, you know, put it in that you're binding, that would only apply to someone that had the knowledge. Someone who didn't have the knowledge or sophistication, you would have to pay. So once again, you have a chiluk there. So there are many machlokas in the halacha. I can't say there's a simple consensus in this, but there's a machlokas haposkim regarding religious Jews invoking a bankruptcy system.
Would a bezdin that would have power in commercial matters be permitted to legislate bankruptcy legislation against the Torah idea?
Well, yes. It would appear that if at the time when we would have a Sanhedrin that has empower to legislate, they would be permitted to legislate bankruptcy legislation. That is a permissible thing for a Sanhedrin to do.
Hefker
based on Hefker. That is correct. Now, let me just mention very briefly some other conflicts between Jewish law and Sufis law, which are issues that have to be worked out. And that is, let's take the laws of inheritance. Right? That's a very big one. The Torah says, we read it a few weeks ago, when a man dies, all of his property goes to his sons. If he has sons and daughters, the son gets everything. If he has a firstborn son, the firstborn son gets a double portion. So if I have two sons, one son gets two-thirds. Right? If I have two sons and a daughter, my firstborn son gets two-thirds, my other son gets one-third, my daughter gets nothing at all. Wife also gets nothing at all as an heir.
Civil law.
No, I'm talking about Jewish law.
Jewish law.
Jewish law says son gets everything, firstborn son gets double portion, daughters and wife get nothing at all. Now, obviously, there are two questions here. First of all, if a person didn't write a will, and secular law will come into play, of course, this varies from state to state, but in most states, a wife will automatically get a third. And of the remaining property, daughters and sons share equally. And there is no right of double portion of the firstborn. So even if a person dies intestate means without a will, what the heirs are going to get under the intestacy law is going to be significantly different in many cases than what they get under the Torah. Now, if the person writes a will, the differences will also be pronounced. Generally speaking, if a person has a good relationship with his all of his children, he'll usually provide, and religious people write wills too, that they want their sons and daughters to share equally, they want their wife to be supported, and the question is this in contravention of Jewish law?
I was going to ask if a will can override primogeniture.
Well, that's part of my question. Yeah, in other words, does it override primogeniture? Does it override sons, daughters and sons, etc.? Now let me explain the nature of the question, because the nature of the dilemma might not be apparent at first glance. If I write a will, let's assume I have a son and a daughter. And to make it easy, let's factor out the wife. The wife is not alive anymore. And I simply say I want my son and my daughter to share equally. Or if I have two sons, one is a firstborn, and I say I want my son and my two sons to share equally. That itself does not yet create a halachic violation. Why? Because I've simply expressed my wishes. If my two children are amenable to carry out what my expressed wishes are, there is nothing against the halacha in doing that. Because after all, even a firstborn who's entitled to a double portion can give the property to his brother. Even a son who inherits everything and a girl doesn't can give property to a sister. So keep in mind, the making of a will itself is not per se a violation of Jewish law, to the extent it is simply the indication of preferences and wishes in the hope that the children will carry it out. Where you get a halachic problem is, however, when the will is being asserted as a legally enforceable document against the wishes of one who is vested as rightful heir under Torah law. Let's take the primogeniture issue. Two sons. One is a firstborn who is entitled to only two sons. So the firstborn will get two-thirds of my estate. The younger will get one-third. I stipulate I want to divide everything 50-50. If the firstborn son is willing to do that, there is no halachic problem in that will. But let's say the firstborn says to the younger son, I demand two-thirds of the estate. That is my right. The younger son says, I have a will that gives me 50%. And the younger son goes to secular court to enforce the terms of the will. The halachic problem here is that since two-thirds of the estate, according to Jewish law, belongs to the firstborn, we're back to this issue. Any other person who is taking property that the Torah says belongs to somebody else in violation of the order of inheritance is committing the Aveira of theft. So the Aveira technically boils down to theft. It's Geneva. Same thing with boys and girls. If an older brother wants to share his property with sister, there's no problem with that. Okay? But let's say older brother wants to keep everything for himself and sister wants to get half. So here's the question. Is enforcement of a will over the objections of the halachically recognized heir, or is that considered to be theft? Or the same issue with a wife, right? You leave something to your wife, but technically it belongs to your sons, right? That's the issue. Now, first of all, before we get into the conflict, let me just emphasize, though, that even within Jewish law, there are certain rights and privileges that are often not recognized. In other words, I describe Jewish law as saying, the boys get everything, the girls get nothing, and the wife gets nothing. That is not entirely so. The halacha is that a woman that is widowed... a woman that is widowed does not inherit her husband's estate, but she does have a right to occupy the family residence rent-free until she remarries or until she dies. She does have that particular right. And she is also entitled to be supported. She is entitled to be supported from the assets of the estate in the manner to which she is accustomed, once again, until she remarries. So she really is a creditor of the estate. The same thing is true for daughters. Daughters... Yeah, thanks for coming. Daughters, and this is by the same token, are entitled to be supported out of the estate until they get remarried. And if there's not enough to support the sons and the daughters have priority. So the truth of the matter is, Jewish law does not leave the widow or the daughters helpless, but it is true that they don't really inherit the estate. So this is the issue. The issue is, are wills halachically valid when they contravene the provisions of Jewish law and the heirs are not willing to cooperate? Willing to cooperate, there's no particular issue. Yet.
You're assuming we're talking about Israeli law, Jewish law here.
Well, no, when I say Jewish law, I mean halacha.
Halacha, okay.
Halacha. And I'm comparing halacha to secular law. Now, secular law can be American law. Secular law can be Israeli law.
You have a problem. If you...
Israeli law is not Jewish law.
I understand.
Yeah.
When you come an aliyah,
yes.
You have an American will.
Yes.
Okay, you don't think about writing an Israeli will, and you say, well, you have everything is fine, you're leaving everything, whoever supersedes who,
yes.
You leave your money either to your wife, or your wife leaves it to you.
Right.
Leaving out the children and child.
That's correct. Well, you have a problem.
Problem.
Now, but the truth is that's not only an aliyah problem, because the truth is Israeli law allows for wills too. So this is not a problem because you've come to Israel. This is simply a problem where it's a problem in America too. In other words, your will contradicts halachic law. It'll contradict halachic law in Israel. It'll contradict. Here's the point that I want to say, and that is that most poskim have said the following. Most poskim have said that there are ways that you can modify your will in a very small way to make it halachically valid. And there are a lot of different ways, but one of the ways you do it is the following. As long as you're alive, right, you can certainly give your property, do whatever you want. In other words, if I have a son and a daughter, let's say, and to take an extreme example, if I decide to give all of my money to my daughter while I'm alive, that doesn't violate the laws of inheritance, because the law of inheritance don't take effect until death. So, consequently, it's been suggested that if you simply modify your will by stipulating the transfers of this will should take place 1 second before my death, that would already suffice to avoid any halakhic violation, because at the time you're transferring a third of your estate or a half of your estate to your son, to your younger son, the older son's right of double portion hasn't yet attached. In other words, as long as you turn it into a lifetime conveyance, and there are more sophisticated ways of doing it. For example, if you establish a trust, a lifetime trust would be, you put money in trust and you say, this is for my children after my life, but I will get the income and benefit while I'm living. So in effect, you've really conveyed it to them while they're still alive, although you're retaining income. And it is said, what is called an inter vivos trust, inter vivos just means among the living, trust, in fact, first of all, there are even legal reasons why an inter vivos trust might be preferable to will. If you have a lot of money, the inter vivos trust can avoid federal estate taxes. Of course, that only applies if you're rich.
Yeah,
if you don't have $500,000, it doesn't apply. But if you have a big, right, if you have a fairly big estate, very often inter vivos trusts are recommended anyway. But the truth of the matter is, from a halachic standpoint, they do avoid some of the problems that wills create, because they take effect while you're still alive. And they don't contravene the laws of Yerusha. But once again, there are a lot of considerations. There are tax issues. I mean, before you change your will, you got to discuss with a lawyer in terms of what are the consequences. But I'm just alerting you that this is one particular Eitzah. The other thing is that Rav Moshe does have a tshuva. Very interesting. The Rav Moshe has a tshuva that actually applies dina de machusa dina to wills. He says that the order of Yerusha can be governed by second law because it's a matter of property, it's a matter of money, it's a matter of who gets what assets, and those things can be regulated by the law of the Malchus. Mm-hmm. The truth is, that's a very big chiddush in a way. It really doesn't seem consistent to me with other definitions of dina de Malchus and dina, but Rav Moshe does have a tshuva. That's why, by the way, you'll find a very interesting thing, that charities, you know, or Sameach, yeshivos, are often going to urge people, remember us in your will. And it's very fascinating that some of these religious institutions are actually telling people to engage in potential anti-halachic behavior by leaving it to a charity instead of leaving it to an heir. Now, once again, I want to emphasize, if an heir is willing to give the charity, of course there's no problem. In other words, I can always write a will saying this is what I want. But the issue becomes, if the charity tries to take it over the objections of the heir, they might be guilty of theft. It might be an iser d'oraisa of Geneva under those cases. So that's another example of conflicts that one needs to be involved in.
I think in Toronto, putting the will to be effective 1 minute before death and becoming an improper will.
Yes, that is a problem. There is a problem that wills, by legal definition, are what are called testamentary. Mm-hmm. They're not supposed to take effect till death. By making it 1 minute before, it may not be a will, and yet. So some write a regular will and they have a separate document that they don't put into the will, which means for halachic purposes, we mentioned 1 second earlier. Yeah.
Even in the case where all parties agree to the conditions of the will.
Yes.
And it being and that will being against the
laws of the Torah.
Right. Wouldn't the executor be committing an error?
No, and I'll tell you why. Because let's assume the will says my two sons should share equally. When one son is a firstborn, is entitled to two-thirds. And let's assume that Reuven is the executor of the will. Now, if the Bechor, who owns two-thirds, says to Reuven, it's okay to me if you give my brother 50%, then the executor is perfectly permitted to follow the agreement of the one that owns the two-thirds, because the one that owns the two-thirds is able to give it away.
Right, but
so what is the executor is not doing anything wrong by following those instructions.
Legally, the younger brother is getting the money from his brother rather than from his
halachically. Halachically, that's correct. You're correct.
And that would be liable to taxation
Okay. You're raising some interesting questions. Meaning, in the eyes of Jewish law, that's a very good point. In the eyes of Jewish law, the younger brother would not be inheriting from his father's estates, but he would be receiving a gift from his older brother. There's the difference between one-third and one-half. Because one-third he's entitled to as a younger brother, which is two-sixths. So essentially, one-sixth of the estate is coming to him not as an heir, but it is coming to him as a recipient of a gift, which may have different consequences. Yeah, so the question is in terms of taxation. I would say the following. I would say that for any purposes that concern secular law,
$1
one is allowed to follow the secular law characterization, meaning even though under Jewish law the executor is distributing a gift, but since secular law would characterize it as a legacy or a bequest, I believe the executor could follow that secular law characterization for secular law purposes. But you are correct. The way it works in Jewish law is not the same thing. But of course, again, keep in mind, if you follow Rav Moshe Feinstein's idea, dinas machlus adina, then it becomes an actual, inheritance. So these are just some conflicts. There's some other conflicts as well. Happens very often in property settlements in the event of divorce. It's a very, very big issue. Most, again, I speak from American law primarily, but I'm sure Canadian has similar ideas. In most jurisdictions, there is some notion called equitable distribution of assets. Husband and wife get divorced, and there's either community property, where everything is 50-50, or there's some type of equitable division of property. Now, under Jewish law, when husband and wife divorce, the wife is entitled to a ksuva, and she's entitled to dowries that she brought in. But in the absence of any agreement to the contrary, she's not entitled to various other properties over and above the ksuva unless they're in her name. So once again, is the enforcement of an equitable distribution of property a theft in the eyes of halacha? Once again, if husband wants to give it, that's fine. But if she's enforcing a judgment to that effect, is there an issue? Or another example is child support, which is a very strange thing. A father is obligated to support his children. That's very true. But under the law of the Gemara, this is one of the strangest halachas, the most difficult to understand, the obligation of the father terminates when the children reach the age of 6. Because by 6 years old already, go out and beg, whatever it is, you know, you don't need, you know, you can do work already. Now, once again, wife gets a judgment against husband for the support of children until the age of 18. Once again, is that considered to be stealing from the husband by imposing
general welfare?
Well, once again, one could argue that. But Rav Moshe has an interesting. Rav Moshe does have an interesting point here. Rav Moshe says that the law of the Gemara that you don't have to support children above 6 was predicated on a custom, on a prevailing understanding that children above 6 were somehow able to somehow earn their keep. In a society where, number one, the law prohibits child labor, and where it's universally recognized that parents take care of their children till the kids reach 18, even though that's a secular law, Rav Moshe argues it is an implicit term of the marriage, that when you marry, it is as if, again, the same argument as the bankruptcy, it is as if you stipulated you would agree to support kids till 18, and if you would have stipulated, that would have been halachically binding. So Rav Moshe does say it regarding the child supports, but he doesn't really talk about the property division. So there are many, many conflicts here. And I do want to mention, I'll probably save this for another time, that I've been talking today about conflicts with secular law. But keep in mind that regardless of law, there's a separate law, halacha, that says Jews are not allowed to go to secular courts to resolve their controversies. That's very distinct. Meaning, and this is a little confusing, even if the law that a Beis Din will apply might be secular law, you still have to go to a Beis Din. Totally separate matters. The law that will apply may sometimes be secular law because of Dina de Malchus Adina, but the forum in which that must be presented.
They override it? You have to make a decision.
Yeah.
You go to a Beis Din. The Beis Din says no, it stops to that.
Well, it all depends what you mean. Can they override it? Can they override it secularly? No, they can't. But if you're asking me Jewishly, yes, because under Jewish law, a decision rendered by a secular court when Jews were not allowed to go to that secular court is a null and void decision in the eyes of Jewish law. Once again, secular law does not look at it that way. And this is something that many, many religious Jews don't know, that we are not allowed, if I want to sue you for a breach of contract or a partnership agreement or whatever it is, I am obligated to go to a Beis Din to have that matter adjudicated. I am not allowed to take it to secular court. Now, there are rules. If you refuse to respond to a summons issued by a Beis Din, and you refuse 3 times, then the halakha will be, I will be given permission to take my action to a secular court. And some are even make it a little further. If it's very apparent, that's what the guy's telling me not to witness, that he will not go to a Beis Din under any circumstances, you know, I could bypass the process. I should also say, too, this only applies between a Jew and a Jew. It does not apply between a Jew and a Goy. I could sue a Goy in secular court. I don't have to go to a Beis Din. And this raises some interesting questions about insurance companies, because very, very often, actual litigation, let's say, for example, I knocked into your car, right? So you're suing me for damage.
So although that looks like Jew against Jew, but in reality what often happens is your insurance company has reimbursed you, and they're now suing my insurance company to get money from me. So it's interesting that, so the question is, if you're suing me, it's really your insurance company suing me, or suing my insurance company, are you allowed to be a participant in that litigation? And the answer is yes, because essentially it's one Geisha company going to another Geisha company, even though the nominal parties parties are Jews. So there are issues there, and in fact we even have issues, can a Jewish lawyer represent a Jew who is suing a Jew, since he is facilitating the commission of a sin? Right, so these are questions. So it's not easy. That's why I'm going to try to follow up.